first, the ones who are. I don't fit in the nice people category. Maybe you don't either. I happen to be one of the difficult people. By definition, difficult people will not do what you tell them the first time you ask. It doesn't matter how diplomatic you are. It's simply not in their nature to say, oh yes. Their nature makes them say, why? What for? Difficult people are as eager to argue a point as nice people are to cooperate. Difficult people are also often persnickety. They would have no hesitation about interviewing a teacher before they decided whether to enroll in a class. They think nothing of insisting that a merchant pay shipping on an item that was out of stock when they visited the store. Remember Meg Ryan's Sally to Billy Crystal's Harry in the movie When Harry Met Sally? When Harry orders his meal, he says, I'll have a number three. Sally says, I'd like the chef's salad, please, with oil and vinegar on the side and apple pie a la mode, but I'd like the pie heated and I don't want the ice cream on top. If not, then no ice cream, just whipped cream, but only if it's real. If it's out of a can, then nothing. Not even the pie? Asks the waitress. No, says Sally, just the pie, but then not heated. You can be sure that if the waitress had told Sally it was impossible to substitute strawberry for vanilla, Sally would have wanted to know why. The word why throws people off, especially those not accustomed to having their orders challenged. When I first went on the streets as a cop, the word really irritated me. It seemed it was all I heard. Step over here a minute, please, sir. Why? What'd I do? May I see your driver's license? Why? In those days, I barked, because I asked for it, acting pompous and inviting a tough time. Gradually, I learned that why is the bottom line in America. That little word can be one of the most powerfully destructive or constructive words in any language. It is the Horatio Alger question that built this country and tore down the Berlin Wall. 30 years of the Cold War didn't do that. It was the word why. The Soviet Union disintegrated when the Russian republics began asking, why should we take our orders from Moscow? Why is the word that created everything from lunar landings to drive-through hamburger joints. It is the word that irritates parents more than any other, but it is also a sign that children are growing up and maturing. Why is the most American question there is. The second and third most American questions, and sure to infuriate, are, who do you think you are to tell me what to do, and where do you get your authority? The fourth all-American inquiry, which, if you can answer it, will help you deal with the first three, is, what's in it for me? When difficult people challenge your authority, it is usually pointless to explain why you've asked them to do something. They may not even care that you are authorized to make your request. They may not even care about the consequences of failing to obey. But they are always interested in how the deal might benefit them. When I want voluntary compliance from a difficult person, I explain early on what's in it for him. As clearly and specifically as I can, I show him what he has to gain. Only when that doesn't work will I tell him what he stands to lose. With kids, it may be useful to inform them that if they keep their room clean every day, they will be entitled to a long session of unsupervised Nintendo madness. If that's not enough incentive, remind them they will forfeit the same privilege if they insist on living in a pigsty. The first principle of physical judo is not to resist your opponent. Instead, move with him and redirect his energy. Ignoring or dismissing a question is the same as resisting it. In verbal judo, you do not try to shut out pesky questioning of your authority, reasons, or methods. It's important to always answer, rather than dismiss the question when someone asks why. Instead, leap into those questions. Turn them into outrageous opportunities. See questions as invitations to explain yourself, to tell what you do, to fill someone in on your views. Here's the chance to educate a person, to win his respect, and provide him with deeper understanding so he won't go away angry. Say a library patron demands to know why citizens have to pay late return penalties on materials that are public property. The librarian could snap that such penalties are meant to discourage tardiness and discourtesy, and thus keep the materials available to a wider range of people. But that tone would insult the patron. How much better to calmly explain with a smile that the fines pay for videotapes, lecture programs, books, periodicals, and many other wonderful things the patrons enjoy without charge. I stop being irritated at difficult people asking why all the time when I realize that I am one of them. They're my kind of people. When someone says, "No, that's wrong. You can't do that to me. What gives you the right to tell me what to do?" I get interested. That's a challenge. I actually enjoy it now when difficult people look me in the eye and say, "Why do I have to do that?" It gives me the opportunity to explain why it's in their best interest to comply. Difficult people built this country. We need to allow room in our system for them and their questions. If you can carry this mindset with you, one that appreciates other people's sense of dignity and self-worth, curiosity and healthy suspicion, you'll never be upset by people who initially challenge your authority. You'll never back away from fuss budgets who nag you to do something especially for them when it's not in your repertoire of services. You'll never go home with a knot in your stomach because you were asked to explain the reasons for what you did or didn't do. There's a big payoff in all this. When you shift from resisting to appreciating and even welcoming difficult people, things become interesting and less tense. The toughest bird of all is the wimp. Wimps are the ones who sound like nice people, but are closet difficult people. To your face they say, "Oh yes, I agree, you're right." They may even compliment you on your words, ideas, or even clothes. They've got the courtesy wrapped down cold, but later they get you back. In the back, baby. These backstabbers are customers or colleagues who act friendly and pretend all is well with your relationship. Then they bitch about you to your boss, to their friends, and to anyone else who listen. And who doesn't love to listen to bad-mouthing? These are the people who will file lawsuits and hire a lawyer to do their fighting for them. If you've ever had a complaint that took you by surprise, you can bet it came from a wimp, someone who didn't have the guts to tell you to your face that he had a problem. Generally, you can assume that you didn't handle the wimp properly when you first encountered him, or you didn't recognize him as a wimp and see the grievance coming. Admittedly, most wimps are good at wimpdom, making them hard to detect. Wimps do not like authority. They hate being told what to do. On the other hand, they don't have the guts to challenge you. Wimps want revenge. They feel the need to even the score. These are the ones who snipe from the corner, sitting in meetings and making disparaging remarks just loud enough to be heard by a few and generate laughs of derision. I frequently face wimps in my classes. Yes, even among cops. I have found the best way to deal with them is to strip them of their camouflage. Not honest enough to be straightforward, difficult people, who are much easier to deal with, wimps usually want to hide behind other people. Often they sit in the back of a room or against the wall or near a pillar or post. When I'm teaching verbal judo and I hear people mutter, "That's a bunch of garbage," I don't let it pass. I say, "Excuse me, what was that you said? I'd like to know." When they try to wave me off or laugh it away, I persist. "No, tell me so I can speak to it." The wimp has been stripped of his cover, and now he has to put up or shut up. Now he can either make a legitimate point, ask a question, or shut up. And if he shuts up, he has lost credibility with his peers. If nothing else, that eliminates the sniping. Many think it's best to ignore wimps, but that's just another form of resisting them. Ignored or resisted, they grow stronger. The basic principle here is to confront them honestly. They immediately weaken. Resist the urge to gossip about these people or snipe back at them. Those are wimp techniques, and they are often better at them than you are, unless you too are a wimp. Outside of my training sessions, in private, I'm even more direct with wimps. Notice that when I'm flushing them out of their cover in the class setting, I'm not embarrassing them. I'm letting them embarrass themselves. If they have a good point or something constructive to say or ask, they can. I haven't put them down or challenged them. I've merely courteously asked them to repeat their comment or question because I missed it. Privately, however, I might be more straightforward. "I understand what you're doing," I'll say. "If you continue, we're going to have a problem. I won't put up with this." The pure wimp, true to form, will immediately back down and even apologize. I still watch them like hawks, however. Exposure is totally unsettling to wimps. Once you've blown their chicken-hearted covers, by and large they will leave you alone. They'll either realize that their tactics don't work with you and give up, or they'll find someone else to bother. Learning to identify and distinguish the nice, the difficult, and the wimp is a basic first step in your journey of mastering verbal judo. Chapter 6. 11 Things Never to Say to Anyone, and How to Respond if Some Idiot Says Them to You. 1. Come here. Ironically, this command actually means, go away, especially when said by an intimidating authority figure. Many street people automatically translate the phrase as, run like the devil. To you and me, come here is vaguely threatening. It says, you haven't obeyed me, so now I'm ordering you to move when I want you to move. I learned in police work that it's much more effective to casually approach a person and say, excuse me, but I need to chat with you a second, or even, could I chat with you a second? I gave the other party the feeling that he had some choice, but my implication was clear. It's best to control the location for such encounters. Samurai warriors caution their students to never let an opponent pick the fighting terrain. The reason was simple. Those who didn't choose found themselves with the sun in their eyes and or on loose ground. If someone with no authority orders you to come here and doesn't seem to have legitimate reasons, ask, why? If you don't get a satisfactory answer, become a street person and run like the devil. 2. You wouldn't understand. I don't know about you, but I find this phrase so insulting that I can almost hear the comma and then stupid implied at the end. No matter who this is said to, it puts the listener off. Better to say, this might be difficult to understand, but, or, let me try to explain this. There's no harm in warning people that what you're about to say is complicated, and that it's okay if they don't get it at first. You can even put the onus on yourself. I hope I can explain this. Just don't prejudge their ability to comprehend, and certainly don't whip them in advance for what may be your failure to communicate. If you're being pressed to reveal something you don't want to reveal, avoid the convenient lie that the person wouldn't understand. Just say, I'd rather not answer that, or the more emphatic, I'm not willing to answer that. If someone brushes you off with, you wouldn't understand, insist, yes, I would. Try me. I want to help. Number 3. Because those are the rules. That phrase would make just about anybody want to throw up. But if you're enforcing rules that exist for good reasons, don't hesitate to explain them. Your audience might not agree, but at least they will have been honored with an answer. For instance, if you tell children they have to go to bed at a certain time and they demand to know why, explain that they will be less cranky and able to have more fun the next day if they get adequate sleep. Tell them that you need their help in doing your job as a parent. It's my responsibility to bring up healthy, happy kids. You do your part, and I'll do mine. If you fall back on, because those are the rules, you'll be judged an insensitive, uncaring oaf. It will appear you are more concerned with your own authority than with the other person's welfare. You may be told, so what? The rules are wrong. If all you can do is repeat that rules are rules and those are the rules, your listener knows you're weak and can't support your order with logic. When you're desperate, you'll find yourself saying, I don't have to explain. I'm the boss, mother, father, authority, one giving the orders. But if you can put the rules or policies in context and explain how they contribute to everyone's well-being, you not only help people understand, you help them save face. And you're also much more likely to gain voluntary compliance. Should someone, who hasn't had the good fortune to read this book, tell you, because those are the rules, say, could you please tell me why this rule was created? It doesn't make sense to me, and if you could help me understand why it was made, it would be much easier for me to follow. 4. It's none of your business. Here is the slam dunk of verbal abuse. It's usually said by a frustrated parent, but it's occasionally heard among friends, too. The phrase angers people because it brands them as outsiders and brusquely cuts them off. It also exposes you as someone who doesn't have a good reason for answering the question. It makes it seem that you have no power behind your position. Rather than saying, it's none of your business, Explain why the information cannot be revealed. You can usually do this without revealing more than you want to. If it's a confidential matter, say why. For instance, the parties involved would not want me to say anything without their knowledge or permission, and I want to honor that. You understand. If you're simply uncomfortable revealing something, just admit that, rather than making the other person feel like a jerk. Telling him it's none of his business leads only to conflict. Have you ever heard someone reply, "You're right, it's none of my business, and I shouldn't have asked"? No, he usually reacts angrily and keeps badgering until you blurt out something you shouldn't have. If someone barks at you that something is none of your business, and you disagree, gently but firmly point out, "It is my business, and here's why." 5. What do you want me to do about it? What a cop-out. The pseudo-question, almost always accompanied by sarcasm, is seen as an evasion of responsibility. It's also a sign that you're exasperated. It's often said by untrained sales clerks in response to complaints, but it's also heard among friends, spouses, and co-workers at the ends of their ropes. When you say, "What do you want me to do about it?" you can count on two problems, the one you started with and the one you just created by appearing to duck responsibility. Rather, offer to help sort out the problem and work toward a solution. If it truly is not in your area of responsibility, point the complainer to the right department or person. If you're unable or unqualified to assist and you haven't a clue how to help the person, nicely say so and apologize. You didn't do anything wrong, but an apology almost always gains you an instant ally. No one wants you to feel bad for something that's not your fault. Say, "I'm sorry, I really don't know what to tell you or what else to recommend, and I wish I did. I'd like to help, but I can't." A concerned tone will enhance your credibility and convey that you're not secretly just trying to pass the buck. If someone asks you, "What do you want me to do about it?" start by explaining, "I want you to listen to me and help me." Then politely explain exactly how the person can help. 6. Calm down. I have a lot of fun with this intrinsically contradictory command. In my seminars, especially with police officers, but also with service personnel, I scrunch up my face into a mean grimace and ask them how calming it is when I say, shouting now, "Calm down!" The command flat out doesn't work. In fact, it almost always makes people more upset. If you've ever tried this on your friends or family, you know. Calm down is criticism of people's behavior and implies that they have no right to be upset. Rather than reassuring them that things will improve, which should be your goal, you have created a new problem. Not only is there the matter they were upset about to begin with, but now they need to defend their reaction to you. Rather, put on a calm face and demeanor, look the person in the eye, touch him gently if appropriate, and say, "It's going to be all right. Talk to me. What's the trouble?" If someone says "calm down" to you, say, "Look, I'm obviously not calm and there are reasons for it. Let's talk about them." That should open the door for that person to help. But if he doesn't respond in a more meaningful way, further discussion is probably unwise. And if you're not calm, it's probably better to leave. 7. What's your problem? This snotty, useless phrase turns the problem back on the person needing assistance. It signals that this is a you versus me battle rather than an us discussion. The typical reaction is defensive. "It's not my problem, you're the problem." The problem with the word problem is that it makes people feel deficient or even helpless. The word can transport them back to grade school when they felt misunderstood and underrated. Nobody likes to admit he has a problem. People prefer to think of solutions. "What's your problem?" makes them feel as if they've already failed. Rather say, "What's the matter? How can I help?" Then you can start a real discussion of the issue. If someone is unenlightened enough to ask you what's your problem, say, "It's not a problem, it's just something I need to discuss. Can we talk?" 8. You never, or you always. These absolute generalizations are lies. Is it true that a child never cleans up his room? Okay, bad example, that may be true. Is it true that your spouse is always late? Accusatory generalizations are rarely true and indicate that you have both lost perspective and will soon lose the attention of your listener. Tell someone he never listens to you, and he will either remind you of several times when he has, or he will be tempted to spitefully prove you right and ignore you. You can also make him angry and leave him feeling there is no way he can ever please you. Better to turn the burden upon yourself and seek his help. When you are late without calling, it makes me feel as if you don't care about me or my schedule. That should elicit an apology, or at least an explanation. But if you jumped in with, "You never call," you're more likely to be reminded of the three times in the last month when he did call. If someone uses such absolute phrasing to you, see if you can see his point. Say, "I know it seems I never help out, because often I don't, but let's talk about it. Is that the real issue, or are you upset about something else?" 9. "I'm not going to say this again." That is almost always a lie on the face of it. Because what usually follows the above phrase, the thing you just said you weren't going to say again, and you will probably say it again and again. This threat traps you, because if you're really not going to repeat yourself, you're left with one option, action. If you're not prepared to act, you lose credibility. If you are prepared to act, you have tipped off your adversary, and he can plan to react to or subvert you. Better to not reveal all your options at once. If you need to emphasize the seriousness of your words, say, "It's important that you understand this, so let me say it again, and please listen carefully." If someone tells you, "I'm not going to say it again," just answer with sincerity, "Okay, I got it." 10. "I'm doing this for your own good." That is guaranteed to turn any listener into an instant cynic. No one believes it. It begs the sarcastic comeback, "Oh, yes, sure, I bet." If what you are doing really is for the other person's benefit, show him that. Offer reasons. Give concrete examples of how his life will improve because of what you're doing. Just as I encourage cops to tell perpetrators to surrender early so they don't have to spend the night in jail, away from their own table and hot food and loved ones, there is a benefit that can be pointed to for anyone you're trying to encourage to do something for his own good. If someone tells you, "I'm doing this for your own good," ask for specifics. If what he says doesn't match your notion of what constitutes your own good, say so. Remind the person, "No one knows me better than I do. I'm the best judge of what is for my own good, just as you're the best judge of what is for your own good." 11. "Why don't you be reasonable?" Not once in my life has anyone come up to me and said, "You know what? I'm in left field today, totally irrational." People may know they're a little forgetful or flaky or out of it, but they're not going to admit to being unreasonable. So you're only inviting conflict with a question like this. Instead, allow people to become more reasonable by being reasonable with them. Use the language of reassurance, saying things like, "Let me see if I understand your position," and then paraphrasing their own words. That not only assures you that you're hearing them correctly, but it also enables them to see their own view as you see it. That approach starts to absorb people's tension and makes them feel your support. Then you can help them think more logically and less destructively, without making the insulting charge implied in the question. If someone asks you, "Why don't you be more reasonable?" force yourself to slow down. Take a deep breath, and in a slow, thoughtful, non-threatening voice say, "I'm being as reasonable as I know how, and with any luck, I'll get better. But apparently I see the issue differently than you do." You will have deflected the attempt to put you down without further antagonizing the person. If you can begin cutting these 11 examples of fightin' words from your vocabulary, you will take giant strides in your mastery of verbal judo, the gentle art of gaining voluntary compliance through empathic persuasion. Chapter 7. The Crucible of the Street. When I landed a teaching job at Emporia State University in Kansas, I tried to keep a hand in both the physical and the academic worlds, which made me a strange bird. I wasn't your typical professor who practiced judo and taekwondo karate on the side and rode with the local cops as a reserve in his spare time. My colleagues thought I was nuts. After 10 years, I had just about had it with the urbane atmosphere of the campus. I was on so many committees, I was meetinged to death. When I was finally assigned to a committee whose sole purpose was to oversee the work of the other committees, I was near the end of my rope. That's when I got serious about the reserve program at the local police department. As soon as I started doing ride-alongs and training on the job, I fell in love with police work and knew I needed to get away from college teaching. I was becoming obnoxious at the university, trying to tell my colleagues how they didn't really know anything about communication skills and that the cops were the real experts. When I finally made the break, they were probably relieved to see me go. The very first night I was out by myself, I found I did not know how to communicate. I stopped a car after midnight for going through several stop signs at high speed. As I shone my flashlight inside the car, I noticed marijuana all over the floor. "You, sir," I snapped. "Step out." The man grabbed the steering wheel with arms as big as my legs and snarled, "I ain't getting out." He added a few choice profanities, and I was stunned. My students sure never talked to me that way. My children didn't talk to me that way. I couldn't remember a sentence put that forcefully to my face. I didn't know what to say, so I just repeated my command. And he said, "I ain't gonna do it." Now what? I stood there in my brand new police boots, looking good. My uniform was clean and crisply pressed. I had a snazzy all-weather grip on my stainless steel .357 Magnum. I was rocking back and forth on 210 pounds, stretched fairly taut over 6 feet 2 inches, and I was feeling in shape. Even my patrol car was looking good. Everything was looking good. But I was just standing there, rocking back and forth, and nothing was happening. So I came up with the worst sentence you can come up with. It rose effortlessly to my lips. "I'm not going to tell you again, sir. Step out." The man just looked at me and said, "Why don't you stop talking about it and do something about it?" I figured his advice was probably better than mine, so with him calling the shots, I acted. With my black belts in taekwondo and combat judo, I know how to lay hands on people, so if that's what he was begging for, I was ready and willing to comply. I'd been doing that all my life. I ripped the car door open, pulled him out, and threw him to the ground. I cuffed him up and dragged him to jail. You can bet I felt pretty good about it, too. About an hour later, I ran into somebody who gave me more verbal hassle, and I only asked him twice. See? I was learning. He resisted, so I threw him down, cuffed him up, and took him to jail. I was made for this job. Things were working my way. About 6:45 in the morning, I was putting the patrol car away beneath the police department when the dispatcher radioed me that there was a drunk banging on the windows. "Could you move him on down the street?" Could I move him on down the street? Man, you're talking to John Wayne here. I went up and asked the drunk only once. I said, "Sir, would you cooperate with me and move on down the street?" When he snarled unintelligibly at me, I threw him down, cuffed him up, and took him to jail. It was the wrong night to be fooling with the toughest new cop on the beat. I went home feeling good. At about 11 a.m., I was awakened by a call from the chief of police, who asked if I would come to his office. "I want to chat with you." I dressed quickly. Though I was 35, not 21, I was still so brain damaged that I went down there thinking I was about to get a commendation because of my good night. As soon as I walked in, I noticed that the chief's voice had changed from the voice I had heard over the phone. "Take a look through the one-way glass into my waiting room and then sit yourself down." There were two couples, big as gorillas, sitting on hard chairs, clearly not pleased. "Who are they?" I said. The chief said, "No, George, that's my question. Who are those parents, and why are they here complaining about your behavior with their sons? What in the world happened out there last night?" Suffice it to say, my explanations weren't good enough. The chief impressed upon me that I had gone about my work all wrong, that there was a better, more conciliatory way to do things. "You've got to reason with people, George." "Well, chief, what should I have said? A man tells me I ain't going to do what you say. What am I supposed to say? I want to be a good cop. Give me the words, and by gosh, I'll use those phrases." The sad fact was, he didn't have any phrases. He told me I should be more persuasive, more reasonable, and try other tactics. But I left with no concrete examples. All he said was, "Don't let it happen again." I went home, snapping like a Doberman. I'd come in for a letter of commendation and gone away with a condemnation, so I was not a happy camper. The only thing I learned that night was that there was something I didn't know. I didn't have a clue to the goal of persuasion. That's why I teach it now. I don't teach reasoning, I don't teach argument, I don't teach debate, I don't even teach logic. I teach the lost art of persuasion, how to effect voluntary compliance. Because of my frustration and the newspaper and phone approach used by Bruce Fair several days later, I soon began to learn more about communication on the streets than I ever had learned in a college classroom. It was clear that the vast majority of police work was verbal, not physical. Recent studies have shown that police work is 97 to 98% oral interaction. It's even higher in most other professions. As I analyzed the verbal and nonverbal communication of the cops I worked with, patterns began to emerge. There were peacemakers and troublemakers, some officers who could end a brawl with a few choice words, and others who virtually started fights by lumbering onto the scene as if ready to take on all comers. Different cops used different styles, but the effective ones invariably employed the same profound and, I believed, definable principles I knew from the martial arts. I soon realized that these principles worked in all sorts of situations. They could help anybody get what he or she wanted, whether that meant arresting a thug without a fight or persuading a storekeeper to issue a refund. If I was right, the same principles would work on everything from soothing an angry boss to motivating an MTV addict to do her homework. After 5.5 years of police work, I went back to teach for a year at Emporia State. This time, I stayed away from all the committees. I wanted books, students, a classroom, and to be left alone to teach. In my downtime, I began writing about the astounding communication tools used routinely by sharp street cops. An article I wrote in 1982 was published in the FBI Bulletin. To my amazement, more than 600 letters poured in from all over the country, asking if I offered training in what I had begun to call verbal judo. I was thunderstruck. I had published dozens of academic articles and had never heard from anyone. Now this little piece had generated response from law enforcement officials, educators, business executives, retailers, politicians, bureaucrats, even parents, all curious about how to apply the principles of verbal judo. At the request of the police department in Abilene, Texas, I put together a verbal judo training course. If this stuff didn't work there, I knew they'd ride me out of town on a rail. I showed up ready to teach with a handful of rough notes and plenty of anxiety. 8 hours later, I was still in town. No tar, no feathers, no fight, no rail. On the horizon, a whole new career. The unconscious competent. If you have had good days and bad days as a communicator, you are sometimes operating at the level of what I call unconscious competence. Without understanding why, you are sometimes effective. Sergeant Bruce Fair, my Emporia, Kansas partner and trainer, is the perfect example of an unconscious competent. He uses verbal judo without realizing it. Most of the time, he speaks brilliantly, but he has no idea why he's so effective. He's a gifted natural communicator. The only problem with being an unconscious competent, especially if you're not as ingenious as Bruce, is that it can be dangerous. If you don't know why you're doing what you're doing, and you're depending on verbal instincts to get you through, you can make costly mistakes. Verbal judo teaches you to become consciously competent in both the use of words and in your nonverbal presence. If it's true that lack of communication is a major factor behind everything from ruined marriages to lost fortunes in world wars, verbal skills are crucial to the survival of society. If you've ever alienated anyone, burned any bridges, or even left them smoking, lost a promotion, or angered your mother-in-law, you have had communication problems. I believe the greatest abuse today is verbal abuse, which is the basis for all child abuse, spouse abuse, drug abuse, and just about any other type of abuse you can think of. In fact, I would argue that verbal abuse is far more prevalent than substance abuse in our country. Tongue lashings are a major reason why people turn to drugs or alcohol. They don't feel worthy. Nowhere is this more evident than in our prisons. As part of my research when I was creating Verbal Judo, I interviewed more than 2,000 prisoners in the Los Angeles area. I wanted to know what prisoners thought made a good cop, but I also talked to them about their lives in general. Let me tell you, our penal institutions are full of people who have been verbally, if not physically, abused all their lives. In their anger and rage, they set out to abuse others. These prisoners, and sadly millions of other people who are not criminals, have never heard words that would make them feel good about themselves. They've never heard gentle encouragement or praise. Their lives have been full of relentless taunts, criticisms, and put-downs. That sort of verbal abuse lasts far longer than physical abuse. Ask yourself if you remember every spanking you received as a child. Now how about a specific personal slam from someone you cared about? A wound inflicted by a hand or even a weapon will eventually heal and fade from memory. But old verbal wounds may never heal. Sticks and stones may break our bones, but words will break our hearts. Words cut deeper and their wounds fester longer than traumas of the sword. That's why we need to be trained to speak effectively. Parents and teachers taught us to read and write, but chances are they didn't train us to wisely communicate the spoken word. Our earliest verbal gaffes were countered with, "Shut up and do as you're told." Have you ever taken a class on how to speak with assurance and ease, or one on presence under pressure? For most of us, it's a sad truth. No one has ever systematically trained us to speak effectively. I earned a PhD in English literature and never took one course in effective verbal communication. It wasn't part of my speech courses, which typically concentrated on how to present formal monologues or how to win debates. Let's face it, those are highly artificial formats that bear no resemblance to real communication. In fact, one of the worst habits you can fall into when drawn into a verbal confrontation is to switch to a speech or debate mode. Unless your parents were natural communicators, it's unlikely that you've learned to talk in a way that strengthens interpersonal relationships. That's the real goal of communication. Outside my own seminars in verbal judo and a few communication courses taught to valued employees in progressive corporations, I know of nowhere that communication to improve relationships is taught. Similarly, there are few opportunities to learn how to receive and deflect insults, how to apologize, how to discipline, or how to praise. Yet it's in these critical communication areas that our power and our weakness lies. If we get any verbal instruction at all, it's probably in assertiveness training courses, where we are taught to be confrontive and avoid being pushed around. There may be value in that, but too many people come out of those courses more aggressive than assertive. They may get what they want, but they win few friends in the process. A prospect sold against his will remains unsold still, goes the old sales adage. Is it any wonder that some of our best-known and most respected communicators sometimes find themselves in big-league trouble because of how they choose their words? Even as polished a communicator as daily talk show host Geraldo Rivera found himself in a slugfest in August 1992 when a verbal spat with an extremist escalated at a Ku Klux Klan rally in Janesville, Wisconsin. Words failed the wordsmith, he admitted later. And when he called me a spick and a dirty Jew, threw something at me and kicked me, I punched him in the mouth. Look at our high-ranking politicians. On the floor of the U.S. House of Representatives, Robert Dornan and Thomas Downey once got into a shoving match when Dornan wouldn't apologize for calling Downey a draft-dodging wimp. Even our alleged diplomats are notorious for speaking without thinking. At a 1990 U.S.-China trade exposition in Seattle, U.S. Ambassador to China James Lilly got suckered into a yelling match with demonstrators and others who protested human rights abuses in China and Tibet. Our diplomat was less than diplomatic when he shouted, "Go back to China, you're a bunch of cowards!" Of course, the next day he had to eat crow and apologize. "It was a mistake," he admitted. "I shouldn't have done it." The talk show host, the congressman, the ambassador, and most of us are verbal disasters waiting to happen. No one has taught us to communicate, particularly under pressure, when it's most important. You may have heard that you shouldn't back someone into a corner, that you should leave him a way out. But has anyone ever actually trained you how to do that with what you say? Verbal judo is a series of simple, hard-nosed principles and tactics that anybody can use, regardless of background. You don't have to be a linguist to benefit from these martial arts of the mind and mouth, nor do you have to memorize any complicated systems. Frankly, I think you'll be thrilled with how simple yet thorough my approach really is. Chapter 8. The Most Powerful Word in the English Language. Are you looking for an instant tension buster? A way to stop gossips and backstabbers dead in their slimy little tracks? Want to turn snarling antagonists into personalities as sweet and smooth as honey sliding from a jar? The answer lies in one word, which represents the single most powerful concept in the English language. Empathy. To have empathy for someone does not mean to sympathize with them. It does not mean to love or even to like somebody. You don't have to approve of him, and you are certainly not required to agree with what he says or accept his invitation to Thanksgiving dinner. Empathy has Latin and Greek roots. M from the Latin means to see through, and pathy from the Greek means the eye of the other. So to empathize means to understand, to see through the eyes of another. It is the most crucial skill in both physical and verbal judo. That's because the moment you stop thinking like your spouse, you're headed for divorce court. The moment you stop thinking like your employer, you'd better start looking for another job. The moment you stop thinking like your friends, you'd better find yourself a new crowd to run with. Empathy is the quality of standing in another's shoes and understanding where he's coming from. Here is the bottom line of all communications. Empathy absorbs tension. It works every time. I have seen it even save a life. The most dramatic example of this I have ever witnessed occurred one cold, windy night 2 years into my police career. I answered a call about a guy threatening to commit suicide. I had been on another call, and when I arrived, I found a bunch of policemen standing around a man lying nude in a bathtub full of water. His toe was hooked to an electric heater, which he was threatening to jerk into the tub. It would, of course, have electrocuted him before our eyes. "You pigs don't understand," he screamed. "I want to kill myself." The officers pleaded with him. "Come on, friend. You don't want to do that. You've got your whole life ahead of you. Things will look better tomorrow." The only problem with that is that the guy knew better. He was the one with the problems. Money, love, job, whatever. And Murphy's Law tells us things aren't going to be better tomorrow. A guy talking suicide thinks Murphy was an optimist anyway. One of the officers turned to me and said, "This is your beat. You handle it." I pulled another cop close and whispered, "Find the fuse box and cut off the power." Meanwhile, I turned to the guy in the tub. Despite what he had said, I believed he was looking for a way out of his predicament. If he really wanted to die, he'd have killed himself. He wanted to be listened to, and now he needed to save face. Instead of trying to talk him out of frying himself in the tub, I decided to move with him. That meant I had to try to think like him. I quickly contemplated what it must be like to face imminent bathtub electrocution. It struck me as an especially horrible way to go. I said, "You know, it's really too bad that of the 105 ways you can kill yourself, friend, you've picked the 105th most painful. You think it's going to be quick, right? You think all you have to do is pull the heater in the tub and you're gone? Let me tell you something. Research shows that death by electrocution in water can take anywhere from 8 to 12 minutes, minutes of excruciating pain. You're going to smell your hair burning. You're going to see the water bubbling and boiling, your skin peeling back from your knuckles, your sternum split. If you think life's been tough up to now, friend, you've got 8 to 12 minutes to consider real toughness. You have never felt such pain." I paused as it became clear they were having trouble finding the fuse box or figuring how to cut the power. "It's a shame," I said. "There are 104 easier and more efficient ways to do it. Why don't you step out of that tub and I'll tell you about them? Some are so quick you're gone before you know it." It may seem that telling someone how to kill himself is anything but empathetic, but it was the only way I knew how to walk in the guy's shoes. And it worked. Just before they cut the electricity, he sprang out of that tub. The truth is, I don't know how many ways there are to kill yourself, and I know very little about death by electrocution, except I understand it's pretty quick. I know I'm not right about the 8 to 12 minutes, but squatting there in uniform next to a desperate man, I must have looked and sounded like the world's authority on the subject. Okay, I was lying. But because I tried to empathize with the guy, I got in sync with him. He listened because I was working with him, trying to help him, if not to live, then at least to die with less pain. He thought he wanted to kill himself. I promised I could help him get the job done better. Admittedly, lying and trickery are not things that easily transfer into your everyday relationships. I don't recommend them. In this case, however, subterfuge was the only thing I could think of to empathize with the man. Though my story was fake, my concern was genuine, and he sensed it. My goal was to help him. Because I focused on him and his predicament, I was able to choose language that allowed him to see the situation as he hadn't seen it before. He wanted to be understood. I am not a social worker. I was never the best cop in the world. But I can try to understand. And then, by the way I used language and tone, I can buy someone another 24 to 48 hours. That's enough time for a man to have a cup of coffee and chat with a professional, somebody trained in helping him reconsider his life. What I did for that guy is what police officers, teachers, parents, ministers, and others do all the time. We help people think as they would do a day or two later, without the influence of fear or depression or temporary brain damage they bring to the situation. A friend told me of a rash decision by his son that could have resulted in a regrettable act. In a typical circle of gossip, the boy's girlfriend heard some things he was supposed to have said about her. She called to break up with him. He was so hurt by being dumped that he fumed around the house, threatening to say about her the very things she had accused him of saying. "There are things I could tell about her," he wailed, "and since she already thinks that's what I've done, I might as well." He went to the phone. "What are you doing?" his father asked. "Evening the score," he said. "I'm going to tell a few of my friends things about her." "Things said to you in confidence? Things between a boyfriend and girlfriend?" "That's right." He was dialing. "Could you give me just a minute?" "Don't try to talk me out of this, Dad. She's already found me guilty, so I might as well do it." "But you are innocent." "That doesn't make any difference now." "I can understand how hurt you are, being accused of something you didn't do by someone you care about. Do me a favor, will you? Give it 24 hours. If you still feel as strongly then, we'll talk again." Notice the father didn't give him permission to spread gossip and break confidences if he still felt strongly the next day. He simply said they would talk again. He knew how quickly things change in kids' lives, and that there were myriad reasons why his son might feel differently the next day. The next morning, when he dropped his son off at school, the boy was still incensed. "Remember, you're giving me 24 hours, and we'll talk again tonight." The boy nodded. That evening, the son was beaming. "She asked me to forgive her," he announced. "She said she should have believed me, because when she called her friends, they all said I had never broken my word or told stories behind her back." The father resisted the temptation to take credit for keeping his son from having done just that. "So you're back together?" "Of course, Dad. Nothing can tear us apart." This is the communication warrior's real service. Staying calm in the midst of conflict, deflecting verbal abuse, and offering empathy in the face of antagonism. If you cannot empathize with people, you don't stand a chance of getting them to listen to you, much less accepting your attempts to help, sincere as you may be. If you take a moment to think as another might be thinking, then speak with his perspective in mind, you gain immediate rapport. Ill-fitting as his shoes may be, walk a few steps in them. Only then can you provide real understanding and reassurance. Only then can you help that person see the consequences of what he is doing or is about to do. Only then can you help him make enlightened decisions. Rodney King. In the most famous police brutality case to date, Rodney King was kicked and clubbed at least 56 times on March 3, 1991, in Los Angeles. I wasn't there, but like just about every fully functioning citizen of North America, I've seen the video more times than I care to. I heard the testimony that King was bludgeoned and kicked because he ignored verbal commands to get down and stay down. and apparently one jury was convinced the staggering, lumbering, dazed offender was a mortal threat to the officers. I don't want to be naive, and nothing I say here should be misconstrued as condoning the violence that broke out with the announcement of the first verdict, but I believe the police officers could have used words alone to take King in. I was training members of the LAPD at the time, and several of the officers on the scene that night were scheduled to be in my verbal judo class the week after the incident. When you finish this book, ask yourself how you would have handled that dangerous, volatile situation, and see if you don't agree with me. Fortunately, the vast majority of us will never find ourselves in such an explosive environment. Our verbal tussles are just as unsettling to us, however, so every tool we can employ, every skill we can master, will only make our lives easier. The highly trained adult professionals who resort to brute force no doubt consider themselves effective communicators, people who don't need to learn anything more about how to talk. That is the attitude of nearly every professional I teach, at least at the start. I find that it takes some in-your-face challenges to get them to sit up and listen. I need to earn the right to be heard, show that I've been where they are in dangerous street situations, and convince them that there are indeed verbal skills that will make them better at their jobs. Chances are that you too consider yourself a successful communicator. You have no doubt occasionally demonstrated impressive verbal skills, whether that meant getting your parents to let you stay up past your bedtime, persuading your dog to stop harassing the neighbors, or sweet-talking your spouse into forgiving you for yet again getting home late without calling. We've all, at one time or another, savored the results of having said the right thing at the right time to the right person. We may have even been able to congratulate ourselves for having kept our mouths shut when it was appropriate but difficult. At least once or twice in our lives, we've responded to insults with a comeback either so funny or so gracious that it was worthy of Billy Crystal or Mother Teresa. So, such responses are possible. With a little luck, they're even repeatable. The question is, are such situations predictable? If they are, if they can be anticipated, then we can be trained and prepared to respond appropriately and effectively every time. Now there's a worthy goal. Can we speak convincingly on those all too frequent days when we're overworked and exhausted? Can we expect the right words to tumble gracefully from our lips when we're negotiating a raise or trying to steer a child through negative peer pressure? Do we know what to say when the plumber says he can't get to our faulty water heater for 2 days? Can we confront our spouse about a problem without irreparably damaging the marriage? Can we speak up at a staff meeting to make an unpopular but vital point without losing our fragile standing within the organization? Do we know which words and inflections produce desired results? Have we any idea when to use them and when it's smarter to simply keep quiet? And if we know these things, are we capable of using them when under pressure? Can we access them when situations turn ugly or potentially violent? Do we know what to say to keep a love relationship from sliding down the tubes? Or is that when we're likely to take the cheapest shots, to make those statements that can never be taken back? In short, can we get up in the morning and expect the right words to come out of our mouths that day, no matter what occurs? Or will we be taking our chances? Chapter 9. The Greatest Speech You'll Ever Live to Regret. When we employ the words that most naturally come to our lips, we run the risk of giving the greatest speech we'll ever live to regret. We wind up saying things we can never take back. This happens most often when we allow others to set the tone in confrontations. We all deal with people under the influence nearly every day. If it's not alcohol or drugs, it's frustration, fear, impatience, lack of self-worth, defensiveness, and a host of other influences. Doesn't it make sense that we should develop a state of mind that will allow us to skillfully interact with these people, whether they be criminals, customers, spouses, kids, or sales clerks, and not let them get our goats? Nowhere in my long, formal education did anyone train me in this. I was trained to confront people, to snap back at them to preserve my so-called identity. I had the macho notion that I wouldn't take any crap, any verbal abuse. Several years later, I realized that being given abuse was something that would happen the rest of my life, so I'd better learn to handle it. A habit of mind. A samurai warfare state of mind called mushin is defined as the still center, or the ability to stay calm, read your opponent, and attempt to redirect his aggression in a more positive way. If you cannot keep a still center, you cannot stay in control of yourself or the situation. The mushin state underlies both physical judo and verbal judo, a mind-mouth harmony, if you will. The English word closest to the idea of mushin is disinterested. Many make the mistake of defining disinterested as uninterested. In fact, disinterested means impartial. Dis is from the Latin root meaning not, and interested is from the Latin word meaning biased. So the word means not biased, open, flexible. As you can imagine, those are the three great traits of not only a good police officer, but also of any good communicator. A closed mind misreads people and makes terrible errors. The flexible mind has the surviving strength of the willow tree, which survives even in heavy winds because it bends. It is malleable. This is precisely what we have to do and be when under the influence of verbal abuse. Being malleable is always superior to that which is unmovable. Thus the judo principle of controlling things by going along with them, mastery through adaptation. This allows you the strength to deal with people different from yourself. I was never taught to deal with people who insulted me. I responded the natural defensive way, which caused confrontation. I thought confrontation was the point. Now I know that a studied response of deflection and redirection is the answer. I discovered it in my study of ancient warfare. In an old samurai text, translated from the Japanese, an ancient master was quoted. When man throws spear of insult at head, move head. Spear miss target, leave man empty-handed. Spear in wall, not in you. That was 10 times better than the Western sticks and stones may break my bones, but names will never hurt me, because the latter isn't true. Insults wound deeply if we don't deflect them. Deflection is a nice concept, but how do you do it? That's my complaint with most gurus and samurai. They don't offer enough specificity. Fortunately, I found my answer in the streets. Strip phrases. One night early in my career, I stopped a pickup truck filled with angry, drunken cowboys after a rodeo. The driver, who appeared to be twice my size, was in my face, calling me all kinds of names. I asked to see his driver's license, and he responded with a bunch of curses. Almost without thinking, I said, "Well, appreciate that, sir, but I need to see your license." He kind of laughed me off, but produced his license. Later, it struck me that my colloquial use of the word appreciate was the key. Of course it had been nonsense. He'd impugned my ancestry and cast aspersions on my manhood, and I had said I appreciated it. Think about that. I was figuratively moving my head so his spear of insult clattered past me. I use the abbreviated version of the word because, of course, I do not appreciate being called names. I could certainly appreciate where he was coming from, because I was empathizing and trying to work with him. So I used appreciate that as what I now call a strip phrase, a deflector that strips the insult of its power. In the martial arts, we teach people to deflect punches, but not hard, for if you block hard, you will push the antagonist away. That gives him more time to recover and possibly even pull a weapon. When a man throws a fist at your face, you want to move your face slightly at the very last instant, allowing his fist to just graze the top of your head. Then you strike back because he's in close proximity. My strip phrase deflector, the loudmouth cowboy, was the same thing. Soon I developed other strip phrases, simple, shortened versions of calm answers. For instance, the next time a subject tried to humiliate me, I said, "I understand that, sir, but listen to me. I need your driver's license." Again, to rationalize the absurdity of my statement in my own mind, I didn't use the whole real word, understand. I left the last letter off, and that somehow allowed me to tell an idiot who had just called me every name in the book, "I understand that." Then I made up another one. It sounds like, "Oh, yes," but I run it together as a one-word strip phrase, "Oh, yes." I responded to every insult with, "Oh, yes." Soon I found that if I combined the strip phrases, they worked even better. A guy would start in with, "You slimy, no-good, blankety-blank of a..." And I would say, "Appreciate that, oh yes, understand that, sir, but let me see your license, please." Crazy as it sounds,